Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs will come to order. This hearing is in our first time, a hybrid format. Our witness is in person. Mr. Gensler is here in person. Thank you. Members have the option to appear both in person or virtually. For those joining remotely, a few reminders. Once you start speaking, there will be a slight delay before you're displayed on the screen. To minimize background noise, please click the mute button till it's your turn to speak or ask questions. You should all have one box in your screens labeled clock that will show how much time is remaining. For those of you joining virtually, you'll hear a bell ring when you have 30 seconds remaining, and then when time's expired, there's a technology issue, we'll move to the next member. Our speaking order will be as usual, that is by seniority, the members who have checked in before the gavel came down, either in person or virtually, and then by seniority of members arriving, alternating between Democrats and Republicans. Welcome, Chair Gensler, back to the committee. 5 months ago today, the Senate confirmed you as chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, one of the historically most important jobs in the federal government. I know you've already gotten to work for the American people. You have your work cut out for you over the past year and a half. The disconnect between the stock market and most Americans' lives have never been more painfully clear. Most of the country's been devastated by this awful virus. Hundreds of thousands have lost loved ones. People lost jobs, lost family businesses. Mothers were forced to leave their paid jobs in droves. Millions today are still at risk of evictions from their homes. You'd never know any of that by looking at the stock market. It hits new records month after month. Listen to this, 53 records since the beginning of the year. Eye-popping gains in the stock market. Crypto assets attracted millions to start investing. And like during past times of upheaval, the COVID crisis opened the doors for bad actors looking to seize upon people's fears and insecurity. Pandemic-related fraud, from Ponzi schemes to offers to invest in COVID-related medical care, skyrocketed last year. The SEC stepped up to educate investors and to punish bad actors. The dedicated public servants at the commission have continued to fight for all the Americans whose pensions and 401ks and college savings are at risk. Many have been enticed by dramatic jumps in the value of new digital assets. They've dreamed of riding the coattails of professional investors and celebrities in a new wave of public offerings of more speculative investments known as special purpose acquisition companies, or SPACs. Some professional investors and celebrities make earning millions look easy. But as we're reminded time and time again through history, it's never that simple. Too often, someone's quick profit comes at the expense of workers, sometimes even entire communities. Chair Gensler, it's your job to make sure that efficient markets are balanced with strong enforcement that protects Americans from the worst Wall Street greed and careless risk, even if that means challenging practices or shady investment products that previous chairs ignored. It means working to increase transparency that the last administration simply did not take seriously. We all know that on this committee. For example, the SEC approved new capital disclosure last year without requiring companies to provide even basic details or data. Just give us some information, we almost disdainfully said. And let's remember, human capital is business school speak for the tens of millions of Americans who work for these companies. Despite the new standard, the investor demand for essential information used to judge how companies treat and manage these workers, most companies barely provide any additional information. My colleagues have been working to improve transparency. Senator Warner of Virginia introduced the Workforce Investment Disclosure Act to get companies to provide important information on how they pay and train and invest in their workers. His bill will shed light on how companies outsource and subcontract their workers, such an important part of our economy now, something he and I have jointly written to the GAO about. Today's tech companies like to say they're more efficient than companies of the past, when in reality they hire the same number of workers. Half of them are just invisible to us under today's disclosure requirements. Senator Warren of Massachusetts introduced the Climate Risk Disclosure Act, calling for significant new public disclosures from public companies regarding the risks climate change poses to their financial results and to their operations. These bills are good policy. The largest investors have been calling for more of this kind of information. I'm a co-sponsor of both bills. Of course, this would just be a start. Transparency is only a first step to getting corporations and the biggest investors to behave better. There's much more you already have the authority to do to make markets work better for the real economy outside of investment firm and hedge fund boardrooms. For too long, the financial system catered to the big guys, left everyone else on their own. Far too many stories of how insiders game the system. Big banks abuse customers while they make record profits. Brokers who've taken advantage of customers use the system to cover up and erase their misconduct. Private equity firms buy up companies and treat workers as a cost to be minimized. Workers as a cost to be minimized. Where have we heard that before? They buy up houses, they raise rent, they evict families even during a pandemic. And of course, no matter what happens to the workers at the companies they've raided for parts, or to the families in the mobile home complex where they've jacked up the rents, or to the larger economy, the big guys, the hedge funds, the SPAC sponsors, the big banks, the brokers, the big guys seem to do just fine. That system isn't sustainable. Increasing people's trust and faith in the market, in the financial system, will lead to more saving and broader participation. Yet some of my colleagues say we should let the market sort it out. They want to tie the SEC's and your and other watchdogs' hands. We know that's counterproductive. It's the same thinking that led to a market collapse 13 years ago that's led to decades of more and more investment flowing to a smaller and smaller share of the country. The last administration subscribed to that same always Wall Street first view and left this country worse off than they found it. The damage is too vast to measure. Our economy and our markets were no exceptions. Investors have fewer tools to hold management accountable. Savers, that's retirees, widows, families, have fewer protection. Corruption runs rampant. Existing serious conflicts of interest have too often been ignored. This administration is taking a different view, thankfully. The economy and the market should work for everyone, not just the well-connected. They should reflect the economy we all want, with broadly shared prosperity and a growing middle class that all workers can join. When that happens, people will have confidence that markets actually work for them, not just for Wall Street. We'll see more Americans save. We'll see more Americans invest in the future. Chair Gensler, I look forward to hearing about the progress you're making toward these goals. Ranking Member Toomey, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chair Gensler, welcome back. It is good to see you despite our significant disagreements. I do appreciate your dedication and enjoy working with you. As you know, the SEC has historically administered securities laws on a bipartisan basis generally. During your confirmation process, I expressed concerns that you might stray from this tradition and use the SEC to advance a liberal political agenda, such as combating global warming and advancing so-called social justice, and push the legal bounds of the SEC's authorities to pursue disclosures that are not financially material to the reporting company. Unfortunately, this appears to be exactly what you're doing. You've added mandatory disclosures on global warming and, quote, human capital, end quote, such as board and employee racial and gender identity to the SEC's agenda. You've essentially said that if large investment advisors and pension funds like BlackRock and CalPERS, who invest other people's money, if they want information about global warming or workforce diversity, it must be disclosed, even if it's financially insignificant and irrelevant to a particular business. Even President Obama's SEC chair, Mary Jo White, opposed using the SEC's disclosure powers for the purpose of, quote, exerting societal pressure on companies to change behavior rather than to disclose financial information that primarily informs investment decisions, end quote. That's exactly what you're doing. And you're well on your way to politicizing the PCAOB after firing all the existing board members. See, it's not the SEC's role nor its expertise as an independent financial regulator with zero democratic accountability to address these political and social issues. Similarly, I've worried that you would favor the paternalistic push by some on the left to restrict investor freedom under the guise of protection while actually harming retail investors. Such harm may result from your apparent opposition to payment for order flow, which helped allow brokers to offer commission-free trading. Payment for order flow allows a broker to keep a portion of the price improvement obtained by routing a transaction to a wholesaler. To my knowledge, the SEC has not demonstrated any failure or harm associated with payment for order flow, which the SEC has allowed for many years. Banning payment for order flow could very well have the effect of eliminating commission-free trading, which would be a grave disservice to average investors. And likewise, you've criticized mobile apps that make investing easy and fun as, quote, gamification, end quote. But in my view, delivering a product that customers like isn't a bad thing. And I worry that you're attempting to fix problems that don't exist today. Today is the best time ever to be a retail investor in the United States of America. Retail investors receive the best execution. A person of modest means can share in the gains of the stock market at negligible transaction costs. We see the tightest bid offer spreads ever. At least four major developments for retail investors made this all possible. Commission-free trading, accounts with no minimum balances, low or no-fee mutual funds and ETFs, and, yes, user-friendly technology like mobile apps. And investors can even voluntarily use a broker who declines payment for order flow but may therefore charge a commission. Now, despite decades of rapidly growing numbers of retail investors participating in stock market gains and enjoying more product opportunities at lower costs, some of my colleagues suggest that the markets are somehow rigged against retail investors. I'd like to hear how it is rigged. Don't retail investors receive dividends like institutional investors? Aren't retail investors entitled to best execution like institutional investors? Don't the value of retail investor shares and those of institutional investors both increase when a stock price goes up? In my view, the SEC's job is not to make retail investing more expensive or unpleasant or difficult. In America, adults investing their own money should be free to decide how to do so. Let me turn to cryptocurrency, which together with the blockchain technologies, this is a very, very important and very promising new technology. As you know, the cryptocurrencies are actively traded on many platforms. A really important question is whether a cryptocurrency is a security for regulatory purposes under the Howey or some other test. Now, based on your public statements, it's pretty clear that you believe that some are securities, but others are not. So I'm frustrated by the lack of helpful SEC public guidance explaining how you make this distinction. What makes some of them securities while others are not securities? Now, I understand that the SEC staff will privately provide feedback and analysis on whether a cryptocurrency is a security, but why is this analysis private? Why not publicly announce what characteristics make a cryptocurrency a security or not a security? In other words, how do you apply Howey and the Reeves tests to these new products? Why wait to make the SEC's views known only when it swoops in with an enforcement action, in some cases years after the product was launched? This is regulation by enforcement, and it's very objectionable, and I'm concerned it can stifle domestic innovation. So, Mr. Chairman, I hope we'll get a better understanding of your views on these and a number of other issues. There are many things on which you and I agree and where we could work together to protect investors, to ensure fair, orderly, efficient markets, and facilitate capital formation. I hope we can work together on these really important parts of the SEC's mission.
Thank you, Ranking Member Toomey. Today we'll hear Securities and Exchange Commission Chair Gary Gensler, no stranger to this committee. This is Chair Gensler's first appearance here in this role. Chair Gensler, please proceed.
Good morning, Chairman Brown, Ranking Member Toomey, and members of the committee. I'm honored to appear here before you today for the first time, as you said, as Chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and I'd like to thank you all for your support in my confirmation this spring. But also note, I think, Chairman, you may be the eighth chairman that I've appeared before in this committee. I'm aging myself a little bit, but I think Chair D'Amato might have been the first that I was in this committee room. As is customary, I should note that my views are my own. I'm not speaking on behalf of my fellow commissioners or the staff. The U.S., as Ranking Member Toomey said, the U.S. is blessed with the largest, most sophisticated, and most innovative capital markets in the world. We actually represent 38% of the world's capital market, and that's when we're only about 23% of the world's economy. They're competitive, they're efficient, they're transparent. But I think we can't take our remarkable capital markets for granted. New technologies continue to change the face of finance for investors and businesses, and more retail investors than ever are accessing our markets. Our countries and other countries are also developing deep competitive capital markets as well. And though I provide greater detail in the written testimony, I just like to flag three areas for now. First is market structure. Market structure is fundamental to our mission to protect investors, on the other side, facilitate capital formation, and that which is in the middle, fair, orderly, and efficient markets. How do we do that? It's through transparency and competition in those markets. So I've asked staff to take a look at a number of market structures. The Treasury market, that's the base of all other fixed income markets. The non-Treasury fixed income markets, corporate bonds and municipals, which, by the way, in the U.S. are twice to 2.5 times the lending out of banks, are loaned through our capital markets. Our equity markets, and securities-based swaps as well. In each of these crucial markets, I think companies and investors alike benefit if we can increase competition, lower costs, and bring more transactions out of the dark. Second is a rapid change in technology. We're living in a transformational time, perhaps as transformational as the internet itself. Now, I expect some members might ask a question or two about crypto, but actually the first thing I just want to mention is artificial intelligence. AI, predictive data analytics, machine learning are shaping and will continue to shape many parts of our economy. And while these developments, I believe, can increase access, increase choice, and lower costs, they also raise new questions about potential conflicts, biases in the data, and yes, even systemic risk. And now for the crypto, because I know that you're all, keenly interested. We just don't have, I believe, enough investor protection in crypto finance, the issuance of these tokens, the trading, and particularly the lending. Frankly, as I've said before, I think it's more like the Wild West. I've asked the SEC staff, working with our fellow regulators, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the bank regulators, the Treasury as well, using our current authorities, how can we best bring investor protection to these markets? I stand willing also to work with this committee and other committees of Congress if you take up any legislative initiatives. And then third, issuer disclosure. You see, since the 1930s, we've had a basic bargain. Investors get to decide what risk they take. That's up to investors. But Congress said that it should be based on full and fair disclosure of the issuers. Over the decades, we've updated what those disclosures are. And today's investors are increasingly looking for consistent, comparable, and decision-useful disclosures around climate risk, so-called human capital, cybersecurity, and other areas. So I've asked staff to develop proposals for the Commission to consider these potential disclosures. And yes, put these proposals out to public comment. Put rigorous economic analysis again, and what is it that investors want to see, and have the public comment. Beyond these policy areas, the SEC employees oversee 28,000 registered entities, more than 3,700 broker-dealers, 24 national security exchanges. You've got the picture. A lot going on in our capital markets, $110 trillion capital markets. Last month, we authorized voluntary return to work, but we've been largely remote for 18 months now. This speaks to the dedication of the SEC staff. I cannot compliment them enough. And while capital markets have grown, the SEC has not grown to meet the needs of the 2020s, though. Over 5 years ago, we were about 4 or 5% bigger. And so I just think that it'd be helpful to be a little bit wise and add to our staff. I hope that you can agree with me on that. Thank you. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Chair Gensler. How a company, as we've discussed privately and you've spoken publicly, how a company treats its employees matter. The SEC can require companies to disclose that information, but instead of crafting a rule that would provide information and data that could give real insight, the last SEC chair wrote a vague rule that companies can interpret to require as much or more often as little information as they like. That lets companies say they pay their workers a living wage with ample paid leave and retirement contributions while subtracting out half their workforce to while subcontracting out half their workforce to companies that pay lower wages with stingy benefits. We know that's a business model for many companies. Now, why is it important to have disclosure standards that are consistent and comparable across companies?
I think that investing in a company, the human capital, the workforce, is a key asset. I remember when I started on Wall Street at Goldman Sachs and we used to sell companies. And when we sold companies, we'd always have a section in that private offering memo about the employees, what they're paid, how many are part-time, how many are full-time, where they're located. retention and the like. It's even more important in the 2020s than I was young on Wall Street because it is so critical to the valuations of the company. Now, again, we'll put this out to, if my fellow commissioners concur, we'll put it out to public comment and see what investors have to say. And then their feedback is going to guide us on any final rulemaking.
I think it's pretty clear investors are going to want more information, like you suggest in your Goldman days. We've talked before about how Wall Street has treated the markets as a game for decades, a game they always seem to win at the expense of pretty much everyone else, including communities in Wyoming and Louisiana and Rhode Island and Ohio and Pennsylvania. SPACs, for instance, draw in companies that want to please Wall Street, sometimes make promises that they can't deliver on. Look at Youngstown, Ohio. There's a lot to unpack with what's happening at Lordstown Motors, whether or not the company's ultimately able to succeed. And I hope it does. It seems clear there were outside investors looking at this not as a long-term investment in a community with a proud manufacturing heritage and a talented workforce, but as a way to make a quick buck with no follow-through. There will always be people, of course, like that, but that doesn't mean we need to encourage risky financial mechanisms to encourage speculation over long-term investment. In a situation like that, when those investors make their money and pull out, companies break promises and workers and community pay the price. What are the risks, Chair Gensler, what are the risks that the SPAC market has highlighted over the last year, and what can we do about it?
I think the special purpose acquisition companies, these blank check companies, the risk are to investors and the disclosure to the investors. I've asked staff to serve up recommendations that we could consider as a commission. But in essence, there's a lot of costs in these. And secondly, they usually have a two-year fuse. And in that two-year fuse, they try to go out and buy something. And a lot of the institutional investors, when that happens, sell. It's called a redemption right. And retail investors are often left holding the dilution or the significant cost of the bankers and the promoters. So we're looking at greater disclosures and also looking at if there's inherent conflicts along the way. And then again, try to put this out to notice and comment and rulemaking.
Thank you. My last question. It's been 11 years since we passed Dodd-Frank. The rules in executive compensation, as you know, remain unfinished. We've seen executive compensation soar. We've watched executives leave with huge bonuses after presiding over fraud and scamming customers. The phrase golden parachute has become a cliche. It's that commonplace. Why is it important to have strong rules to claw back incentive-based compensation when executives got that compensation by breaking the rules, and why should and disclose the relationship? How important is disclose the relationship between executive pay and financial performance?
Let me break it in two things. For the SEC, it's important to move forward because this committee and then the whole Congress with the president put it in law, and it's a mandate that we shall follow. I remember being a staffer sitting on the other side for Senator Sarbanes. I know that that's how he felt. But two, in terms of the substance, I think why Congress addressed this and put it into law is that if there's a material misstatement or omission in the financials and those financials need to be restated, then the executive shouldn't benefit. And there was a certain number of years, a look back period, a clawback period that Congress said, well, then you should give up the performance-based compensation if it was based upon faulty numbers.
Thank you, Senator Toomey.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Gensler, one area that appears to have nearly universal agreement is the benefit of a faster settlement cycle for equity securities. As you know, market participants seem to be confident in a T+1. My understanding is that you support these efforts. I appreciate that. I would just encourage the SEC to move ahead as quickly as reasonably possible so that that can proceed. I also think there's widespread support for fixing the money market fund rule by removing the link between the 30% weekly average liquidity and the possibility of imposing fees and gates. You and I have discussed this. I don't think there's a need for regulatory reforms that would eliminate or reduce the viability of money market funds as an investment, but improving this regulation would reduce the risk that I think the regulatory regime imposes now. I am concerned about the SEC not adequately fulfilling its capital formation mission. Last year's appropriation law instructed the SEC to deliver two reports to Congress by the end of June, which would help benefit small public companies. These reports are now past due. I certainly hope the SEC will submit those reports promptly. And you testified to the House that the SEC would have a report on GameStop and Robinhood by this summer. That report has not been produced yet. We got a week left in the summer. I do certainly hope that we will see it soon. Now, let me turn to cryptocurrencies. And my time is limited, so I'm going to try to do this as efficiently as I can, Mr. Chairman. But I think I know your position, among other things, is that not all cryptocurrencies are inherently securities, right? That's true.
There are a small number that aren't, but I think that, as Chair Clayton said when he was in front of Congress, I think very many of these facts and circumstances are investment contracts.
So here's my concern. So some are and some aren't is basically what you're saying. And I'm concerned that the SEC has not provided sufficient definition for, and explained how it would apply the Howey test, which I think is the court standard for determining when something is an investment contract. So, for instance, stablecoins do not have an inherent expectation of profit. They're just linked to the dollar. Now, you might use them in an attempt to make a profit, but that's a second-order activity. Is it your view that stable coins themselves can be securities?
I think that, Senator, they may well be securities. As Thurgood Marshall wrote in the Reeves opinion, in defining the scope of the market that it, Congress, wished to regulate, Congress painted a broad brush, and it actually included about 35 different things inside the definition of a security in the 33 Act.
I've just got limited time here, so I acknowledge that. Here's my problem, though. I think what you just said was that they may be securities or that some are securities. To me, a stablecoin doesn't meet the second prong of the Howey test, that there has to be an expectation of profits from the investment. And so if it doesn't meet the Howey test, it looks to me like it's not a security. Now, maybe you've got a good argument for why some are and some aren't. My whole point is, I think we need to have clarity on this. I think you should publicly disclose this. Apparently, there are private conversations where you work with people who are proposing particular structures and you give them advice, or your staff gives them advice. I just think we ought to have that publicly, and we certainly shouldn't be taking enforcement action against somebody without having first provided that clarity.
Well, Senator, this Congress and could change the laws, but the laws that we have right now have a very broad definition of security, including a note, including an investment contract and the like. And my predecessor, Chair Clayton, and others actually put out a lot of guidance with regard to the Howey.
I just got to push back a little bit on that. It is broad, but it's well-defined. There is a very specific litany of the instruments that constitute securities, as you know this better than I do. Investment contract is one of them. And there is a court decision that lays out the prongs for what constitutes an investment contract. I'm just saying, as a layman who can read English, when I read those tests, stable coins don't seem to meet that test to me. Maybe I'm wrong, but if I can misinterpret this, I think others could too, and some clarity, public clarity, I think would be helpful.
I see the red light, but I agree with you that some of these tokens have been deemed to be commodities. Many of them are securities, and the Supreme Court has weighed in a number of times. You noted the Howey test. We've talked about the Reeves test was in the 1990s as well, has weighed in, and I think that there's a fair amount of clarity. Over the years, the SEC has even found, believe it or not, whiskey caskets, and the courts agreed in the 1960s. Were investments. And I think that at the heart of our securities laws was protecting investors against fraud. They get to decide. They get to just take the risk. You'll find I'm not negative or a minimalist about crypto. I just think it would be best if it's inside the investor protection regime that Congress laid out.
I see my time has expired, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Toomey. Senator Reed from Rhode Island is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome, Mr. Chairman. Cybersecurity is one of the greatest threats that we face, both as a national security threat and also as an economic threat. And in 2018, the SEC issued guidance with respect to public companies. I've been trying over the last several years to enact legislation, Senate 808, the Cybersecurity Disclosure Act, which is very simple. It would require a public company to disclose whether they have a cyber expert on their boards, and if not, why not, i.e. they have other means to compensate. In fact, we did precisely that when it came to financial experts. We do require a financial expert on the audit committee or an explanation why they do not have one. Do you believe that the framework in S-808 would be appropriate for dealing with cyber?
Senator, I thank you for highlighting that and our conversations over the last couple mm-hmm. months. I've asked staff to take up two initiatives on cyber, one company disclosure and one with regard to funds, the investment funds. And on the company disclosure side, I've asked them to look very closely at your bill and see whether we would not only potentially include that as a recommendation, but also some other issues around, I'll call it cyber hygiene, and then secondly, incident reporting. When you do have an event or pay ransomware, for instance, when do one report? And that's in the, you know, 6,000 or 7,000 public companies. And then separately, we're looking at something around funds, the cybersecurity of the investment management field.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would encourage you to continue to pursue this and would very much like to see my legislation become law and your regulations become adopted. So thank you. Another issue that's come up, and we're all very happy about the increased retail participation in the stock market. There is a lot of people who never owned stocks before that are buying stocks. And some of it is the result of discount brokers offering zero commissions, aggressively marketing, et cetera. But there's another aspect of this, and that is the payment for order flow issue, where a lot of these brokers have essentially deals with high-frequency trading firms in exchange for rebates. They will send their orders to these firms. And the question is the owner of the security getting the best deal, or is the intermediary getting a lot of money? And it looks like there is a disconnect, their inherent conflict of interest. I think you described it recently. So are you trying to move forward efforts to evaluate this practice of payment and see if it is fair to the consumer?
We are. I've asked staff to take a look at this. It's been about 16 years since we did major rewrite of the national market structure. And I think the inherent conflicts of payment for order flow and rebates on the stock exchanges both may make our markets less efficient. And this is important for capital formation, and it's important for the retail investors that all three senators have already raised, is that retail investors may not be getting best execution, even if they get a price improvement. But there is price improvement versus a sort of out-of-date measuring rod. Mm. And if you measure against the wrong measurement stick, it doesn't mean you're getting best execution. Mm. So we're looking out for retail investors. If anybody on this committee or staff legally traded in the retail markets, there's like a 97% chance that it does not go to a transparent exchange. It goes to the dark markets or the wholesalers. And so it's harder to get best execution when you're not competing order to order. So I'm like deeply a markets person and believe in the competition of markets to bring those orders in competition.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just you mentioned in your opening remarks that one area you're looking at is the your Treasury market. And I think that's critical. As you know, in March 2020, there was a free seizure of the market, not by opponents, but the whole market sort of seized up for a moment. And a volatility in the Treasury market is very much of a danger to the entire economy. And so I would ask that you continue to look very closely at the Treasury markets. I know we've tried to learn lessons from March 2020, but I don't think we fully learned all the lessons and incorporated them in action.
I agree with you, and it's one place I hope that there's maybe even more bipartisanship. I'm working closely with Chair Powell at the Federal Reserve, closely with Secretary Yellen and her team to try to bring more resiliency, safer Treasury market, but also more competitive, that we might lower the cost to all of us, the taxpayers, because we are the issuer in that sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kennedy is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I read your editorial in the Wall Street Journal today about the Holding Foreign Companies Accountable Act. For what it's worth, I agree with most of it. It's a damn good bill, by the way. If I may say so.
I want to thank you for, I think it helps us do our job both at the SEC and at the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board.
I appreciate that. I agree with you, obviously. There's a 3-year implementation period, as you know. Foreign companies, including our friends in China, have 3 years to comply. The Senate's passed a bill reducing that to 2 years. We're having a little trouble getting the House to take it up. Would you be willing to contribute your considerable efforts to encouraging the House to take it up?
Senator, I've already had some discussions and expressed to some of the leadership over there that I support that.
Okay. Who pays corporate income taxes?
Senator, it's the corporation that pays the taxes, of course, then ultimately the owners of those corporations are the shareholders.
Corporations just is not a payor. It's a tax collector, isn't it?
Well, I'm not here as an expert on the tax code. I think the corporation literally...
If you're an expert on corporations, I think... Economists are generally in agreement that the corporation is not a payer, it's a tax collector. The owners and the customers and the workers that Chairman Brown spoke so eloquently about actually pay the tax, don't they?
Well, again, I'd never want to mince words, but I think that the corporation, of course, is paying, and then the shareholders have less net income.
Don't the workers pay it too?
I think that it's a cost of the corporation. It, like all costs of the corporation, those costs compete with each other, even
yeah,
the cost
the
of the real estate.
Do
and
the
so
workers
forth.
Pay it? I'm just trying to, I don't have much time. Sorry about that.
I'm the workers pay individual income tax, workers pay Social Security tax and the like.
I just want to be sure I understand your testimony, Mr. Chairman. You're saying that the workers are not impacted at all by the corporate income tax?
I'm sorry. I thought you were asking a different question. All costs in a company compete with each other, whether it's the real estate costs or any other costs.
Are the workers impacted negatively by corporate income tax? Real simple question.
No, I understand it, but I think it's best as the head of the SEC to leave
you don't want to
debates
answer.
About taxes to Congress. I really do think that that's
I understand
something.
Why you don't want to answer it. I get it. Look, I don't mean any disrespect to you. I followed your career. You've had quite a career in public service. You've made a lot of money on Wall Street. I respect that. I honor that. But as to the people and the companies that you regulate as chairman of the SEC, do you consider yourself to be their daddy?
No.
Then why do you act like it?
I try to take the oath of office seriously that the SEC is set up to promote investor protection and facilitate capital formation and that which is in the middle.
Yeah, but why do you impose your personal preferences about cultural issues and social issues on companies and their therefore their customers and their workers, like climate change and the Second Amendment. I mean, I'm sure you have personal feelings about abortion. Do you have plans to implement or impose those values on companies?
So I want to thank you for the compliment you gave me, and I've followed your career and have the deepest respect for you too, sir. I think that I am not doing that. I think what I've been trying to do is say, if investors want information about climate risk, and it looks like tens of trillions of dollars of assets under management of asking, we at the SEC have a role to put something out to notice and comment, do the economic analysis, and really see what investors are saying. It's really in that narrow set of chalk lines that we're operating.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Senator Kennedy. Senator Tester from Montana is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank Chairman Gensler for being here today. I just got to say one thing really quickly. I've got a farm. My wife and I have a farm. We have a corporation. That corporation pays the taxes. We don't. And we're the only stockholders of that corporation. And that corporation exists over the last 30 years or so, has, quite frankly, helped us financially as we move forward. So just a different perspective. I want to talk about Citizens United decision, which I believe is one of the worst decisions that's ever come down from the Supreme Court. Incredibly detrimental, has ended up with literally hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars flowing into our political system in an untransparent way. I don't think it helps with our democracy. That being said, the SEC has the power to require companies to disclose corporate political spending. Now, the money that these companies put into campaigns may or may not be determined as being materially important, but nonetheless, it depends on who you're talking about. If somebody throws $1 million at me in a campaign, it's materially important for me in that campaign. It may not be materially important to that corporation. Right now, the current appropriations bill prevents the SEC from doing anything about these contributions. Do you believe shareholders should have access to that material information about how companies who these shareholders own spend their money?
Senator, I thank you. And as you noted, there is the appropriations rider. But putting that to the side,
yep,
if you're asking, similar to the other issues around climate risk and human capital, to the extent that investors want to see that information, and it looks like an increasing number of investors do,
yep,
I mean, we see that each of the shareholder voting periods, there's been petitions on this to the SEC and so forth. I think the SEC has a role. Similarly, put things out to notice and comment and see what the process brings.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that answer. I've talked about this in this committee before. I think we really need to take a strong look at extreme weather events. As a farmer this year, for example, this is my wife and my 44th harvest. It was the worst one by far ever due to drought and due to extreme weather conditions. If you take a look at the amount of money that the American taxpayer is putting out for extreme weather events in this country, it is billions and billions and billions of dollars, and it may even be trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. I think it is irresponsible for us not to look at the impacts that climate has had on our lives and on our economy, because this ain't going away, and it's getting worse. And so, as chairman of the SEC, how do you view your work in considering the impacts of climate change as they pertain to your role as a regulator?
So, again, as I've said to other senators, our role is prescribed by Congress about the issuing companies, these 7,000 or so companies, and the investing public, and to bring consistent, comparable disclosure where investors want it. So in climate risk, investors have been asking for it, and hundreds of companies amongst the 500 largest, I think it's 80+% disclose something, but we can bring consistency, comparability, and make the decision useful information.
For the investor?
For the investor, and it would be regarding to some of the physical risks that you mentioned,
yep,
but also the transition risk over time.
Okay. Senator Reid talked to you a little bit about cybersecurity. Could you briefly, in the next minute, talk about the list of cybersecurity requirements that the SEC is looking at implementing?
I think I'm willing to meet with you and or your staff to go through.
I should have prefaced this by saying, not unlike climate change, this problem is going to continue to get worse.
I couldn't agree with you more. So there's two lists we're looking at. One is those activities, how are you managing your cyber risk? Because it's a real risk. How are you governing and managing it? And what are your sort of, I'll call, cyber hygiene? Secondly is incident reporting. If you have a breach and you're paying ransomware and the like, what are you saying to the public when this occurs? Especially if you have private information. Some companies have tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of millions of the American public's confidential information then taken by the bad actor who has just breached the law.
So it would be your work is going to be in the realm of hygiene and reporting the attacks.
That's correct.
And the system they have in place.
Yeah, the system they have and incident reporting. But any advice you have and your staff, we look forward to having good conversations.
We look forward to it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Tester. Senator Lummis of Wyoming is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for joining us, Chairman Gensler. It's nice to see you. I have two questions. One is specific and the other very, very general. So I'll start with a specific. In your previous tenure at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, you were an advocate of providing no action relief to regulated financial entities within your jurisdiction. Now, over the last few years, the SEC has not provided no action relief to innovators, in my opinion, nearly enough. The SEC has also provided 21A investigatory reports on matters of general interest under the Exchange Act. What would you say to innovators who are nervous about approaching the SEC? And how can you improve the use of no action relief in other public statements like 21A reports?
Senator, I thank you for that question, and thank you for our continuing dialogue about innovation. I do think that Congress gave the SEC important authorities, not only to do what you called no action letters, but exemptive authorities and the like. And so I have said, come in, whether it's in the cryptocurrency space or in other innovative spaces, come in, talk to us, and see if our rules for custody, for instance, which I know we've talked about, or transfer agents or something, don't quite fit because they were written in a bricks and mortar time and now we're in a digital time, let's talk about that. If we need to go to Congress, go to Congress, but maybe we can cobble together something. We did this in money markets in the 1970s. Good people in the state of Pennsylvania, Senator Toomey's state, came into the SEC and sought authorities to do money markets, and that's now a $5 trillion asset class. So I think there's room here to sort things out and try to figure it out, to keep things investor protection focused, but to sort out the new innovations.
And my adjunct question is the general question just about innovation. Do you support responsible innovation?
Oh my gosh, yes. It's brought us these lights in the room. It's brought us this ability to have a hybrid hearing with your fellow members. I mean, innovation is what supports access, economic activity, and gives so much of us better opportunities in life.
So given that, how do you right-size the protections that are within your ambit to innovation generally?
No, it's an excellent question that I'm sure this committee grapples with decade after decade. I think it's the core public policy framework around ensuring that the public's not defrauded, that somebody's not misleading them and lying to them, to ensure that if you hold somebody's asset, you don't misuse it or abuse it, so to speak, the physical asset. And then on trading platforms at the heart of our 1934 Act was that competition basically drives to more efficient market, and people don't manipulate that market, don't front run, for instance, in those markets. And I think that these basic tenets of anti-fraud, anti-manipulation, but pro-competition lower the cost of capital for companies raising money and innovators and entrepreneurs, even if they're using, for instance, cryptocurrencies and the like. But I think that inside that policy envelope that we have is a great deal of opportunity. I think it's at the heart of our economic success these last 90 years that we have deeply market-based economy. I said we have the largest capital markets in the world, almost 70% greater than our economic share, 38 points versus 23 points. There's a reason, and I think it helps our economy. But it's also because it's regulated, anti-fraud, anti-manipulation.
So what gaps do you think exist, and what additional regulatory authority would be useful, both at the CFTC and at the SEC, specifically with regard to digital assets?
I think that we have a great deal of authority. I think there's more clarity than some members on this committee. I mean, I know we're maybe a little bit different on that. But I think that in terms of the gaps, we have a great deal of clarity on, I think, what's a security. But the gaps is the coordination amongst our agencies. So, for instance, the coordination with the banking agencies on stable value coins that Senator Toomey raised earlier. The coordination with my sibling agency that I was honored to chair, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, on the tokens themselves and the platforms, because to the extent something is a commodity, even the CFTC doesn't have regulatory authority, they have enforcement authority, a wonderful piece that Dawn Stump wrote recently that I thought was worth reading. But working together with the CFTC and how to coordinate, and then there's some in the, I would say, infrastructure side, things around transfer agents, custody and the like that I think we could work with Congress to help clarify.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Warner from Virginia is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your comments about, in your opening comments about my legislation that deals with disclosure around the workforce. I want to come to that topic, but I want to quickly, Chair Gensler, respond to a couple of my colleagues' comments. One, I want to agree with Senator Reid. Payment for order flow, we've been talking about for close to a decade, and we need to sort through it. I think there would be broad bipartisan agreement about that. Let's make sure we make that happen. On incident reporting in terms of cyber, I think the Intelligence Committee probably has as much visibility into that space as anyone, anywhere. We have virtually every member of the Intelligence Committee, Democrat and Republican, together on a bipartisan mandatory incident reporting bill for critical infrastructure, for federal contractors. We're trying to work through details. My hope is we can work with you. If you're going to have a mandatory reporting requirement, you've got to have a penalty or it's toothless. But we are trying to work with industry to make that happen because I think, as echoing Senator Tester, it's only going to get worse. And you know, as someone who shares some of your concerns about crypto, I will acknowledge that you have only put one wild in front of West as opposed to two wild, wild West. And as somebody who's worked with Senator Toomey and Senator Loomis, I think there's, and somebody who managed to do pretty well financially because of innovation, I'm all in. But we do need some guidance. We do need some direction. This is, I would go to the two wilds in terms of the description of this area. As good as some of the innovation is, Senator Loomis, some of the things I see from the intel side scare the dickens out of me. So we need to figure out a way to, you know, maybe I ought to join the caucus because we got to find a way to come together on this area of innovation, but also area where I can assure you abuse. I will give industry one credit here. When we were going through this definitional process, I heard from more newspapers, newsletters, entities for a group that says they're not very well organized. I've never seen a group that's got as many publications as the crypto world already has. Let me get to my last 2.5 minutes, get to the topic I wanted to address, which is human capital investment. I think we've all acknowledged that, you know, every CEO says, my biggest asset, walks out the door each day, human capital. Yeah, we don't have any virtually any reporting. I agree with the chairman. You know, when companies offload their workers as contractors, they're really not putting their money where their mouth is. So I think our Workforce Investment Disclosure Act, which passed the House, I hope will be part of the guidance of what kind of activities you take. We've got to make sure we have ways, because I believe investors want to know employee retention. They want to know what kind of skills and training is taking place. Matter of fact, I hope that you will also go beyond workforce and really look at the whole realm of ESG reporting. Investors want this, yet there are no standards at this point. I'm not saying we need to move to mandatory across the board, but we really need some more look there. And I do want to make sure I get a question in here. And this is, again, a topic you and I have talked about in the past. I've got other legislation that would create the equivalent of an R&D tax credit, which was a radical notion, as you know, in the accounting world back in the 1970s and early 80s, to create an R&D tax credit type equivalent for companies that invest in upskilling, particularly low and moderate paid workers. I think creating an asset class around human capital makes some sense, or at least is worthy of a discussion. And I hope you'll be willing. You can pick any of those items along the way, Chair Gensler, and comment back. But I hope you'll focus on the workforce piece. Thank you,
Senator. I thank you on cyber. I look forward to working further with your staff, and I share your view in the crypto space. There's an intersection that it's a way to subvert our current anti-money laundering laws and subvert various things that in the Intelligence Committee we're all trying to protect on. I didn't use that term. I want to be respectful. I mean, I just used one wild. I also look forward to getting out to your great state of Wyoming when all these masks go away and everything. But on the workforce, just to say, we have looked closely at your bill and other committee members. It's like ultimately what investors tell us during the notice and comment period too. So when we put something out, hopefully that you'll weigh in, also all of the members here will weigh in and say, do investors really want this information? I've always found that if you're going to buy a company or sell a company, when I was doing that at Goldman Sachs, that people really wanted to have a thorough review of that workforce. And it's ups and downs. It's an asset, and it's a critical asset. So I couldn't agree with you more on that, sir.
Thanks, Senator Warren. Senator Tillis of North Carolina is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chair Gensler, thank you for being here. Are you familiar with Rule 17J1 under the Investment Company Act of 1940, excuse me, and Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934?
Yes, generally, sir. Yes.
Yeah, just for others' edification, 17J1 under the Investment Company Act of 1940 and Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 are the two provisions used by the SEC combined with judicial precedent to prosecute individuals for the practice of front running. This prohibition on front running includes any efforts to do so, including via information obtained through payment for order flow. So is the practice of front running already illegal?
The practice of front running is against the rules that you said, but also the exchanges. A number of the exchanges, self-regulatory organizations, have that. And it's really to protect the public, that if I put an order in, that I can get that inside the market and somebody's not going to take that and use it in front of me.
I know that you've been critical of payment for order flow, contending that it presents conflicts of interest for broker-dealers and that retail customers are harmed through inferior execution quality. Do you still stand by that?
I think that we need to take a look at this whole market structure, because many orders are not competing with other orders. If you placed an order to an exchange with a broker, I'm sorry, if you placed an order, it might be bought by one party, and as has been publicly disclosed, there's one wholesaler that has 50% of the market share in the retail market. And so it's really about, are the orders competing with other orders? So I'm pro-competition, and I'm not sure that this payment for order flow system really is the best competitive landscape.
Is it accurate to say there's another safeguard designed into the system, this one by retail brokers, to cure potential conflicts of interest for payment for order flow arrangements from all of their execution partners? In other words, this means that the execution partners will pay the same rate and act within the same system, essentially putting all execution partners in competition with one another, on execution quality and not payment for order flow.
So I think the challenge is if a party is buying all the order flow or bulk of the order flow, then the order-by-order competition doesn't exist. So the retail public doesn't benefit from that competition. That, like, when I was growing up, you had competition. It wasn't the modern technology, but it was competition on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, and brokers could scream and yell at each other about what they were going to pay. Now, if one party is buying literally half the retail flow in America, these market orders, that could actually have diminished competition in the marketplace.
Do you think the retail brokers should route the route orders to the market center where they have the highest likelihood of obtaining the most favorable execution for their customers? Why or why not?
I've asked staff to consider the economic analysis and really think about the whole market structure. How can we lower the cost of capital formation and raise the returns for the retail public and the institutional public? And we've not updated in 16 years that national market structure. So I think it's really it's almost like a sweater where everything's knitted together. And I was quoted recently about if something was on the table, I said yes, because I think in this area, kind of it's all on the table to think about the rebates at the exchanges, what's called the tick size, the national best bid, best offer, all with one goal, competition in the marketplace to lower the cost and raise the efficiency. That helps capital formation. It helps investors.
Thank you. I'll probably add a couple of questions for the record to expand on that, but thank you for your answers. I want to talk a little bit in my remaining time about the gamification of retail investing. How would you describe gamification?
It's a term that I must admit I'd only heard in the last year or so, but if I can broaden it out, it's encouraging.
And do you think government should prevent gamification?
I think the role of the SEC is about protecting investors. So I think the question is, are there conflicts that arise by doing behavioral prompts to encourage Senator Lummis to trade and sending Senator Lummis a different prompt than Senator Warner or Warren? And they've sort of differentially marketed to the three.
Go down that path, I want to be respectful of time, but if we go down that path in states like mine that have an education lottery, I think in Maryland you have a similar lottery. If we go down that path and we look at possible restrictions or eliminating gamification in the investment sector, why wouldn't we apply that same logic to lottery systems across the nation or any publicly gamified ventures?
I think what I'm interested in learning, and we just put out a public comment, a request for comment, not even a rule, to ask, could you help us, the public, comment on if a platform is maximizing to revenues by marketing to each of these senators in this room differently, could there be a conflict rather than considering what's best for each of you as in your families for your investment needs? And so it's that these platforms are now optimizing based upon our Fitbit, based upon our mobile apps, based upon how we drive our cars. They're maximizing based upon all this data. And that's brings us greater innovation. It's a plus to innovation, a plus to access. It can be a plus to lower cost. What we're just raising is, could it be a conflict as well if they're trying to market to everybody differently?
Thank you.
Thanks, Senator Tillis. Senator Menendez from New Jersey is recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. Chair Gensler, good to see you. As we all know, the asset management and investment consultant industries are overwhelmingly white and male. We also know that study after study has shown that greater diversity leads to greater profitability. So in an effort to improve performance in these industries and thereby benefit everyday investors, the SEC's Asset Management Advisory Committee unanimously recommended that the SEC take several tangible, concrete actions to improve diversity in the industry in a way that is aligned with the SEC's own diversity and inclusion goals and its mandate to protect investors and promote fair and open markets. Have you had the opportunity to read the full advisory committee's report?
Sir, I'm familiar with the report. I've read a summary, to be candid with you.
Have you been briefed by the authors of the recommendations and the advisory committee's diversity and inclusion subcommittee leadership?
I've met with the leadership of the committee.
Have they advised you about it?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes,
well, these recommendations, they're simple. They're straightforward. For example, one is to require enhanced disclosure requirements on gender and racial diversity of advisory firms. Some firms already report this information voluntarily. Another is to establish a procedure to allow the SEC, when it receives reports of discriminatory practices, to direct reporting parties to the government agency best equipped to investigate the complaint. None of this is particularly difficult or controversial, as is evidenced by the unanimous vote of the advisory committee. So given that broad support, can you commit to bringing these items before the commission for a vote before the end of the year so we can bring transparency and diversity to the industry and ultimately deliver better market outcomes for investors?
I've asked staff to look very closely not only at these recommendations but other recommendations with regard to issuers, but you're speaking about on the investment management side, and make recommendations up to the commission with a full docket. I don't want to say what time that will be. It might be after the end of this year.
Let me just say you've been around here for a while, and I get similar answers from every chair. And the problem is we never end up with any concrete steps to creating the diversity that everybody claims that they support. So I'm tired of hearing about we're going to study it, we're going to get more recommendations. I want to know, what is our pathway to action?
So, sir, we're doing more than just studying. I've asked staff for recommendations on the issuer side, as we've talked about earlier, about human capital, and that's the 7,000-plus issuers, and that includes diversity, includes workforce statistics, as Senator Warner and I were discussing as earlier as well, and Chair Brown. So I've asked to bring that up in front of the five-member commission. It's a lot to take on to do the economic analysis, and it'd be very investor focused, because we have to live within the chalk lines. This is about investors and what investors make their decisions upon.
Well, we'll be following up with you. This is an issue I've been pursuing for some time, and without satisfaction, to be honest with you. Should shareholders of companies that make public pledges expect their company to act in a manner consistent with the stated company policy?
I think it's at the bedrock of our securities laws. President Roosevelt called the first act in front of Congress, the 33 Act, the Truth in Securities Law. And so you're talking about that if you make a pledge to your shareholders about building a factory or any pledge, that you not defraud the public, that it be an honest rendition and of the disclosures you're making.
Well, after the insurrection attempt earlier this year, many companies made public pledges to stop donating money to the 147 members of Congress who objected to Congress's certification of President Biden's victory. However, since then, many of these companies resumed their political donations in direct contradiction to their public pledges. So I don't believe necessarily that they follow what they say. So therefore, do shareholders have the right to know whether their company's political donations contradict their public commitment and whether those companies may be supporting outcomes which might pose a material risk to the company's bottom line?
If it poses, as you say, a material risk and there's been a material misstatement to the public, that's at the center of our securities laws.
Well, I look forward to seeing some enforcement in that. Finally, due to public health concerns in November of 2020, FINRA provided member firms the option to complete branch office inspections remotely for calendar years 2020 and 2021. What's your assessment of the quality of those remote inspections? Do you think regulators sacrifice any oversight by allowing these remote inspections? And because we're still facing with the Delta variant pretty high, is the SEC considering extending remote inspections given the current public health?
Senator, we are. I mean, we as a nation are living through the most challenging time, at least in my life, health-wise and economically related to that. When I have conversations with our head of examinations, we have about a 1,200-person examination unit, I ask that very question. What do we lose? What do we gain being remote? And there are trade-offs. We've gained people aren't commuting as much. The people have a better work-life balance and so forth, our examiners. What we lose is you're not sitting in a room eyeball to eyeball talking to somebody as you're trying to inspect a fund or a company and so forth. But yes, we're looking at extending this just because of the realities of this health pandemic that we're in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott from South Carolina is recognized.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you for holding this important hearing today, and thanks to the ranking member for his comments earlier on, his opening statements about the importance of having market accessibility to all Americans. And it seems like we've been heading in the right direction for quite some time here over the last 10 years or so. And some of the concerns I have, Chair Gensler, is that what I've seen from a policy position from you so far seems to may actually jeopardize that path to financial opportunity for the average American. I think back to my days in business when I was in the insurance and for a small time in the financial services business, that I would tell my clients oftentimes that there are really only three ways to create wealth in America. First is real estate, and one of the reasons why we focus on the American dream is synonymous with home ownership. And there's no question in my mind that the fact is that you build equity in your house, and you're actually building equity in this nation. It's your share of the American dream that is so powerful and important that we focus on. The second way that you create wealth in this nation and experience more of the American dream is through having a business, and have that business grows and it becomes more profitable, and that net worth that you see accumulating is a part and parcel to the American dream. And then finally, it's having an equity position in the marketplace. And to the extent that we make it more affordable for the average person to invest in this marketplace, they have a chance to literally experience the American dream, to exceed their wildest imaginations financially. If you think back 32 years ago, do you have any idea what the percentage of American households that were investing in the stock market?
Well, we've grown, particularly in the last 10 years.
32 years ago, any idea what it was?
I don't know the specific number, but lower than today, about 10 points lower.
Good answer. So 32% of American households 32 years ago had access to one of the three streams that leads to creating wealth in this nation. And much of the reason why they had such limited access is because the fees to make a trade were so darn high. Imagine today the average stock price is around $119 with the S&P 500. If you invested in a stock in the 70s and 80s, your stock would have to increase to $139 before you made a penny, because you were using that increase to pay the transactional cost. Today, it's zero. So literally, you have a chance to invest in the marketplace because we've gotten rid of those high transactional costs. So as you said, today, the actual number of households that are able to invest in the market, 53% of households are invested in the market. Why? Because the price to get involved in the market plummeted. And so when we hear things like banning payment for order flow, it sends shivers down the spines of people who have waited for this day to come. 15 years ago, it was $15 or $20 to make your trade. Today, it's nothing. It literally, you have access to a market. If you're a rural America living in Saluda, South Carolina, or inner city Chicago, for the first time, you have a chance to be in the marketplace. Under the Biden administration, those opportunities could vanish away so quickly. And that is painful as a kid who grew up in poverty who now has access to the market. 40% of the households in this nation who make less than $75,000 they're in the market. Why? Because it's affordable. We have to trust Americans to make their own decisions on their own investments and not have a paternalistic regime helping protect Americans because they can't figure it out for themselves. And I'm concerned about that. And my question for you is, what is your plan to ensure that the existing system and the potential for innovation within that system continue so that the average retail investor benefits from that and we don't see ourselves going backwards that leads to higher trade costs so that fewer Americans are able to invest their hard-earned money in the way that they see fit?
Senator, I'm sitting here thinking, one, how much my father, Sam Gensler, if he was alive today, would like you, because he would have agreed on your 3 points about real estate, start a small business, which he did. He never had more than 30 employees. And as a kid, he used to toss us value line tear sheets, and he'd say, what do you think of this stock? And he'd try to buy 50 shares or something.
Yes.
I couldn't agree with you more. In terms of the retail investing, I think that's a positive thing in America, and it was when I was a kid as well. On the cost, we can always do better. And what I'm saying is technology is driven down and competition is driven down the cost of, as you said, investing. But there's still a cost left. The payment for order flow, even if it's a couple pennies out, is a cost. It's buried behind the scene. What I've raised to the Economist with Jessica Wachter and her whole team is, can we do better to have more competition that orders compete with orders rather than one wholesaler buying half of the retail flow in America? And so it's about trying to even do better in these great capital markets we have, but we can't take anything for granted. So I think we're more aligned than you. It's about trying to drive it down even lower cost.
And Chair, I'll take it at your word. And frankly, it sounds like your father was an amazing guy who had a chance to own his house, start a business, and invest in the marketplace.
And never went to college and raised 5 kids.
Yep. And that's the story of the American dream. One of the things I hope that we protect is the notion that the American dream is accessible for all Americans. And when we have within the administration parts of the puzzle that could make it worse for the average person in our nation, I think we should pause and take a serious look at how the market works and how can we make it better. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator Scott. Senator Warren from Massachusetts is recognized.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. We hear a lot about how crypto is all about financial inclusion, a way for people who don't have a lot of money to be able to manage it or invest it. Now, the banks have done a pretty lousy job on financial inclusion. So I want to test out with you whether or not crypto is an improvement. Last Tuesday, the crypto market tanked once again. The prices of Bitcoin and Ether each fell by about 10%, while a bunch of other tokens failed by as much as a third. So in a matter of hours, $400 billion in market value disappeared. Poof, just gone. And meanwhile, several of the biggest crypto exchanges had outages, which kept customers from making withdrawals or trades. So how did that affect people who don't have a lot of money to lose? Chair Gensler, let's say that last Monday, I took out the last sliver of my savings. I went on the crypto exchange Coinbase. I bought $100 worth of Ether. Then I woke up early on Tuesday morning. I saw that the market looked like it was beginning to tank, and I thought, I better sell right now. But when I tried to sell, Coinbase, the exchange, was down. So, Chair Gensler, was there anything I could do to get my money out?
Not at a federal agency because they haven't yet registered with us, even though they have dozens of tokens that may be securities.
Yeah. Okay. So that sounds pretty risky to me. But let's say that instead of buying Ether on Coinbase last Monday, I decided instead to put that $100 toward buying a cool new token. Let's call it NuCoin. That was being hyped on Twitter. Now, NuCoin is available only on a quote-unquote decentralized crypto exchange. So to buy it, I had to pay a fee, about $20 to the crypto miners who process the transactions. That's $20 to buy $100 worth of tokens. But I figured that was okay because Twitter told me that Nucoin was going to make me a lot of money. But then, of course, I woke up on Tuesday morning and the market was tanking. So let's ask about this one. Chair Gensler, on Tuesday, when I wanted to sell Nucoin and get back to dollars fast, that exchange had not shut down. But remember, I had to pay $20 on Monday to get into decentralized finance. So how much would I have had to pay to get out of DeFi on Tuesday to sell my coins? Would I have had to pay a second $20 fee, or might I have had to pay even more?
I don't know, because it'd be all in the user agreement. And by the way, you put quotes around DeFi. I think that's helpful because they're really decentralized in name only. There's a user agreement. There's something you're doing with this platform. There's a governance token. There's usually some fees, but I don't know what the particular fees would be.
Well, actually, we do know some of the fees from last Tuesday. The fee to swap between two crypto tokens on the Ethereum network was more than $500. Obviously, way more than the $100 I was trying to trade in the first place. So the question I have is, in the face of these high, unpredictable fees, small investors could easily get jammed and wiped out entirely. Chair Gensler, advocates say crypto markets are all about financial inclusion, but the people who are most economically vulnerable are the ones who are most likely to have to withdraw their money the fastest when the market drops. Does this sound like the path to financial inclusion to you?
It's a highly speculative asset class. It doesn't sound like the path that you mentioned.
Yeah. You know, there are a whole list of problems with crypto. Unreliable tech, scams, devastating climate impact. But high, unpredictable fees can make crypto trading really dangerous for people who aren't rich. Regulators need to step up to address crypto's regulatory gaps and ensure that we're actually building the inclusive financial system that we need. And Chair Gensler, I expect you and the SEC to take a leading role in getting this done.
Thank you.
Thanks, Senator Warren. Senator Daines from Montana is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Chair Gensler, for being here today. I want to, join my colleagues by expressing my concern with the SEC's posture towards cryptocurrency and blockchain. Keyword here is innovation. As I've said before, I believe a lighter touch regulatory approach is what's called for here, and that overregulating this young and emerging industry could drive jobs and innovation overseas in the global race, which we should all agree on would be a very bad outcome. America's long led the world in innovation, and we must do our very best to ensure that the conditions continue to exist for America to lead in this space, and especially in the crypto sector. Chair Gensler, you have on multiple occasions asked crypto companies to come in and speak with you. However, many of these companies that have come to speak with you have soon after found themselves the target of enforcement actions or even legal threats. The question is, what's the process for the SEC to provide guidance, and what might companies expect from talking directly with you?
I thank you. I want to say I think the way we innovate is within public policy frameworks. But we have asked companies to come in, talk to us. If they're trading or lending a security, there's a registration regime. And companies since the 1930s on for 90 years have found ways to innovate but register or seek an exemption or seek a no action letter and work with us to ensure that they're registered. But there's a public policy framework around that.
So you're drawing lines, though, I think, through public statements without actually going through an APA process. What kind of responsibility do you have to provide clarity to market participants as opposed to really chilling the marketplace through some of these vague speeches vague remarks, vague interviews.
So I, with all respect, I think that actually the SEC has the authorities that Congress granted to, and it's a very broad definition of security. It includes investment contract, includes note, includes 35 other things. My predecessors put out various guidance, Chair Clayton and so forth, put out guidance in this area as well. And so I think come in, talk to us, not you, Senator, but, you know, the entrepreneur, and work within an investor protection regime that also facilitates capital formation. I fear if it stays outside this field that I studied for 3.5 years at MIT, I have a belief that this has been a catalyst for change. But I think if it stays outside of the public policy framework for anti-money laundering, tax compliance, investor protection, it's not going to long persist.
I want to shift gears for a moment and talk about China. You've made it clear that you will be increasing oversight of Chinese firms who are trading in U.S. markets. However, it's not clear to me that the SEC is doing enough as it relates to the oversight of Chinese broker-dealers who have substantial U.S. customer bases, and frankly, they're growing rapidly. My question is, what's the SEC doing to ensure that Americans are not unknowingly having sensitive personal and financial information transferred to the Chinese government?
Senator, if I could ask if we could meet, you know, one-on-one or with your staff and so forth, because I want to understand more about your concerns there, because I do think that's an important issue to ensure that Americans are protected, their personal information, their privacy is protected, just as if they were working with a U.S. firm.
Yeah, it's just having spent a lot of years in the cloud computing world, it's a real threat where this data resides and the access the Chinese government would have to this very sensitive and important personal information. I want to shift to the CFTC for a moment. You've previously acknowledged the need to work together with the CFTC to provide effective oversight on the crypto market. At the same time, you've stated that, quote, many tokens may be unregistered securities, end quote. What role do you see the CFTC playing with respect to oversight of the crypto sector? And in your capacity as SEC chair, have you had any conversations with the CFTC on this topic to date?
Yes, I've had some really good conversations with Acting Chair Benham. I was honored to chair that agency once as well and think the world of the agency. I think we each have respective jurisdictions. They have an enforcement authority on commodities, not a regulatory authority. We have a regulatory authority where we can write rules and we can register companies that are trading platforms or and the like. But on those trading platforms, there may be some commodities on it. So what Chairman Benham and I have been talking about is how could we partner up using our existing authorities to best protect investors.
Right. Chair Gensler, thanks for your time.
Thank you. And I look forward to following up on that China issue.
Thank you, Senator Daines. Senator Cortez Masto from Nevada is joining us remotely.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Chair Gensler, thank you for joining us. Let me jump back. This seems to be the topic of conversation with my colleagues, the cryptocurrency. One thing I just want to verify, is the SEC sufficiently equipped, whether by regulation or funding, to appropriately ensure compliance and keep pace in the cryptocurrency market? Do you believe so? And if you don't, then what would we be doing in the committee? What do we need to know to help you with?
I think you've raised both points. I think funding-wise, we could use a lot more people. I just have to be frank with you. I mean, there's 6,000 projects, and while some of those are commodities, many of them are securities under the laws, and many of the platforms are. So we could use some more funding. In terms of legislation, I think the what I've said earlier in this hearing is the coordination between the market regulators is strong, and Chair Benham and I have been talking through how to do this, but there may be things that Congress can weigh in and help on the coordination, and also around stable coins, the coordination with the banking regulators. And then there are some things, frankly, a bit in the weeds about transfer agents and custody and the like.
Thank you. And so let me just say, I look forward to working with you on that. Whatever we can do here in the committee to support how we address and look at the cryptocurrencies, please you know that you've got support from me. Let me talk a little bit about gamification. When you were here in March for your confirmation hearing, I raised concerns about behavioral prompts and gamification. And I said that free apps that encourage trading could be detrimental to some retail investors. So I know that you were looking at this. Ranking Senator Toomey mentioned that you had talked about doing a report sometime this summer and putting a report on, out, if I remember correctly. Can you talk a little bit about where you are and your concerns with gamification and how it impacts investors?
So three things. One, on the GameStop report, we are pretty close. It's in front of my fellow commissioners, and I would assume it will be out shortly. On quote, gamification, we've asked the public through a request for comment to give us feedback. I think the issues there is we are living through a transformational time in America, and we're seeing this in every bit of our society and so forth. But if Netflix figures out that I'm a rom-com guy, and yes, I am a rom-com type of guy, I might see a bad rom-com for an hour and a half. But this is about people's investing future. So what I've asked, I think the core question is if the data analytics are maximizing the platform's revenues, optimizing for revenues, optimizing for data collection, that may be in conflict with maximizing for the user's investment returns, and how do we square that? And lastly, if I could, and I apologize respectfully, say it's not actually free on these apps. It might be zero commission, but you're still paying. The payment for order flow is underneath the hood, and it's still there. And my real concern is about whether the competition is there, whether it's sufficient order-by-order competition.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification. And then let me just add one final thing, and I know Senator Tester talked about this, but climate risk. We've seen from the West, and particularly Nevada and California, some of the worst wildfires we have ever seen because of the extreme weather, impacting the air quality as well that we breathe. And so I know there was this discussion earlier about why should the SEC be concerned about the climate crisis and climate risk. But would you talk a little bit about this? I understand you have said that investors should be able to understand what is under the hood of green or sustainable funds. What do you mean by that?
So we have, I thank you for asking that. We have a separate rule docket where I've asked for recommendations from staff. There are funds, asset managers, that are marking themselves as green or sustainable or carbon free. And just as we walk into a grocery store and it might say fat free, it's like, what's behind that marketing? And I think that actually probably will unite senators in this committee. I mean, what's behind the marketing and the name? And so staff will make recommendations, but I hope that we would say something about that there has to be some metrics standing behind if you're marketing yourself, so to speak, as carbon free or green.
Thank you. And I would assume there's a reason why they're marketing themselves that way, because that's what some investors are looking for. Is that correct?
I think that's right. I think that investors mm-hmm. increasingly are interested. Investors get to decide in our the basic bargain of our capital markets. Investors get to decide, but investors also get to decide how they make their decisions. All the SEC is trying to do is response to investors, say, here's how we can maybe help bring consistency, comparability, and some decision useful information.
Thank you. Chairman Gensler, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you, Senator Cortez Masto. Senator Warnock of Georgia is recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Brown, and thank you, Chairman Gensler, for your testimony. America's capital markets are some of the most robust and transparent markets in the world, but not everyone has equal access to them. In Georgia, people of color account for nearly half of the total Georgia population, while only about 23% of Georgia startups are minority-owned. Women-owned businesses are also lagging, with women accounting for only 38% of business owners in the state. And according to a study by the Kauffman Foundation, Black entrepreneurs are three times as likely as white entrepreneurs to report that their business's profitability is negatively impacted by a lack of access to capital, and almost twice as likely to cite the cost of capital as hurting their business's profitability. Needless to say, all of us have a stake in the ability of entrepreneurs to pursue the American dream, to create jobs. Chairman Gensler, what initiatives is the SEC leading right now to increase diversity within the venture capital industry?
We have a number of tools in the toolkit, and this question came up earlier for Senator Menendez, too. We had some recommendations from an investment advisory committee earlier this year, and I've asked staff to say, all right, now what can we do with regard to disclosure regimes in the investment management side? We have more clear disclosure regimes in the company side, the issuer side, than the investment management side, but there's something, it's in the weeds, form ADV, that we're taking a look at more closely.
What tools do we have to increase diversity?
We're very much at the SEC of a disclosure-based regime, and disclosing to decision makers, investors, about those funds or the companies they invest with, and ensuring that disclosure is what those investors want. So it's sort of like it's got to come from investors. We stay in the chalk lines we talked about earlier, and both on the invest on the issuer side and the investment management side, what investors wish to make their decisions.
And so the role you play in providing that kind of transparency and disclosure is I understand that. But let me ask in a different way. What is the SEC doing, or in your view, what could the SEC do to help encourage investor capital funds to look outside of their traditional geographical areas for investment and opportunity in other areas of the country, and not just in big cities like Atlanta, but small cities like Augusta and Macon and Columbus? I think a lot of this happens because without intentionally doing something else, there's a way in which the way things are traditionally done has its own momentum.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think it might sound like back to basics, but fundamentally, it's the middle part of our mission, making sure that the markets are efficient and competitive. And even in the private fund space, we have some projects to promote competition in that space, so that the person raising money in Georgia or elsewhere of any background, ethnic, racial background, that the cost of them raising money is lower as well. For that small business entrepreneur raising money, that it's not just a friends and family round, but they can go to a venture capitalist, as you say, and raise money efficiently.
All right. I'm going to shift to another topic. It's vitally important, and I think we all agree, that investors have confidence that financial regulators are keeping their protection top of mind so that our markets work for everyone. The pandemic has wreaked havoc on our nation and caused significant strains for every aspect of Americans' lives, including hardworking families in Georgia and throughout the country. Georgians face layoffs, small businesses permanently closing, and having constantly to worry about the health of their families and loved ones. Through all of this, criminals saw an opportunity to prey, particularly on vulnerable populations, and commit fraud, whether it is tricking folk into investing in companies falsely claiming to be producing medical equipment, or businesses using the pandemic to disguise their own fraudulent dealings. What tools and resources do you believe Congress can further provide your agency with to support in its work to fight fraud and protect retail investors?
I thank you for that question. I think two areas. One is, frankly, funding. We've shrunk during the prior administration by about 5%. We've grown a little bit since this new administration, but we're about 4% down in headcount, and yet retail investing is up. We've been in the middle of a pandemic. We've got the challenges of doing things remotely. So it'd be good at a minimum just to get back to where we were in 2016, And I think we actually should get a little bit further than that. And in two, in some areas, and we've talked about the cryptocurrency area, is really just to help bring people into the investor protection remit, because right now there are many individuals in this country that have already been hurt, and they're unfortunately going to be more spills on aisle three, so to speak, old grocery store term, but because this crypto area is trying to stay outside an investor protection perimeter.
Thank you so much, Chairman. We certainly want to see job growth. We want to see the economy continue to thrive. And my first question, I guess, is about equity, and the other about integrity. We need both of these things in order for the market to perform for everybody.
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you, Senator Warnock. Senator Smith is recognized from her office.
Thank you so much, Chair Brown and Ranking Member Toomey, and welcome, Chair Gensler. It's nice to be with you virtually.
It's good to see you.
I have a specific question to start with. Having a safe and secure retirement is a crucial goal for so many American families. And here's my specific question. Registered index-linked annuities has become a rapidly growing savings option for many Americans. In the first quarter of 2021 alone, more than $9.2 billion of these annuities were sold. So here's the problem. The SEC doesn't have a registration form for these products. Now, this might seem like not a big deal, but it is a big problem and kind of a classic bureaucratic quagmire. Because what it means is that for big portions of the year, these new products can't be registered at all. And when they are registered, reporting costs are higher. The disclosure forms have a bunch of information that actually isn't that useful to investors as they're trying to find the information that really matters. So I've introduced a bipartisan bill to fix this problem. And I'm really glad that the Consumer Federation of America, a leading investor advocacy organization, is supporting my bill. But as I think you know, the reality is that we don't need legislation to fix this problem. We don't need congressional action. The SEC has the authority to create a new registration form itself. And in fact, I think the SEC has literally dozens of product-specific registration forms in place. So my question to you, Chair Gensler, is can you commit to me today to issuing a new registration form for registered index-linked annuities?
Senator, I know that we have different regimes for index-linked annuities, and so I look forward to working with you and your staff and learning more. Just 5 months into the job, I have to admit that I don't know all the details of the RILAs, but I look forward to working with you and your staff about the potential of doing, as you say, another form, because I think we do have different forms for indexed linked annuities. But
right. Thank you. Yeah, this is a very, it's a specific thing, and it's something that I think we could solve relatively easily. And I hope your agency, when you are releasing your updated regulatory agenda soon, I would love to see a fix for this issue on that regulatory agenda.
Again, I look forward to meeting with you and getting our staffs together to understand. I think our staffs have already chatted, but to understand it even better.
I think so, too. We'll follow up, and I look forward to working with you on this. So let me ask you a slightly broader question. You know, we often have conversations in this committee about risk disclosure to investors, and I think there's general agreement that the market works better when investors have clear and trusted and transparent information about the risks that businesses face, and that information is provided in a systematic way so that investors can compare risks across organizations. But some of my colleagues on this committee just take a completely different approach when it comes to risk disclosure for climate change. And this just doesn't make any sense to me when, as Senator Tester pointed out, we are seeing billions and billions of dollars in costs for extreme weather events caused by climate change. And that's not only a public sector cost, it is also a private enterprise cost as well. So right now, when companies release climate-related information, if they release any at all, it's not in a systematic format or with any specific guidelines. And I think this is a problem for investors. And it gets, as you say, the goal of the SEC should be to protect investors. It's also a problem for regulators, as Chair Powell has laid out and talked about to this committee earlier this year. So I just want to commend the work that you and Commissioner Allison Herron-Lee have done so far on climate risk disclosure. I'm glad that you're working to solicit comments on how best to address this problem. And I understand that you're reviewing those comments right now. But let me just ask you a question about this, Chair Gensler. Why do you think that climate risk disclosure is an important priority for investors to help them understand climate risk?
Well, I think investors have spoken loudly to your question, and companies right now are making disclosures. They're just not consistent disclosures, and it's better when it's consistent. But why it's important is there can be physical risks, of as we've seen, whether it's from flooding or weather events and the like, but it also can be transition risks, the transitioning to a new economy as we globally address this. But investors are really demanding it, and the role the SEC might have is to help bring some consistency and comparability to all of this.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your work on this. Mr. Chair, I don't see climate risk disclosure as a social issue. I see it as systemic risk that investors face because of climate change, and it's important that we all understand that, including investors. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator. Senator Van Hollen of Maryland is recognized, and thanks for your patience, Chris.
No, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, great to see you. Let me start by thanking you for your efforts to move forward on a rulemaking on 10B5-1 plans. Senator Fisher and I had bipartisan legislation that would have directed the SEC to look at this, because you know well that public confidence in the markets requires confidence that there's not insider trading, and I look forward to your rulemaking in that regard. I just want to try and cover a couple other points. One involves the whistleblower provisions. As you know, we have whistleblower laws designed to encourage individuals to surface cases of fraud. And beginning in 2010, a Marylander, John McPherson, who's a former forensics accountant, gave the SEC what the SEC described as, quote, extraordinary and continuing, unquote, assistance that helped the agency shut down a $1.4 billion investment scam by a company called Life Partners Holdings, Inc. Despite his substantial assistance, Mr. McPherson did not receive the whistleblower award because the company went bankrupt. And as a result, the SEC did not collect its fine. But the case did require over $1 billion for investors. As you know, in bankruptcy, all the lawyers and accountants got paid. But the person who was the most instrumental in bringing this case to light and exposing the fraud did not receive his whistleblower award. So I want to work with you and the SEC to see if you can, through your existing authorities, make sure that he gets what would normally be expected in this case, or if a change in law is required to work with us. Because I think you would agree, would you not, that we do want to continue to incentivize people to bring these cases to light?
Senator, I agree wholeheartedly. I know the work that Senator Grassley did to bring this whistleblower regime into place. The SEC to date has had a really robust whistleblower program, and it's helped the American public, the investors public, but I look forward to working with your office on this matter.
Right. I mean, this kind of situation obviously may discourage people from coming forward at great risk potentially to themselves if at the end of the day.
But what I don't know yet is whether it will need a change in law rather than something in our current authority.
That's what we're exploring now with your team, but look forward to continue to do that. So turning to Didi. In July, following the collapse of the share prices of Didi, I urged the SEC to thoroughly investigate the incident to see if investors were intentionally misled by Didi's public disclosures. As you know, that collapse in share price came shortly after
after that happened. I know you can't disclose whether there's an ongoing investigation. I commend you for the statements you've made generally about reviewing listings of Chinese companies on the U.S. exchanges. Can you expand on that? And I heard Senator Kennedy also reference your op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal regarding implementation of the legislation that he and I introduced on holding companies responsible to ensure that we're allowed to see their books through an independent entity to protect American shareholders and investors. Can you just talk about both those pieces of the need to better protect American investors?
So there's about 270 Chinese-related companies in our capital markets, between $1.5 and $2 trillion, to give you a sense of scope and scale. But many of these, actually, the U.S. cannot invest directly. See, in China, they prohibit foreign ownership in the internet and telecom and other fields. So there's been a form of setting up a shell company in the Cayman Islands. That Cayman Islands company raises money in the U.S., and it has some operating arrangements with the Chinese company, which, by the way, usually is still owned 100% in China by friends and family and so forth. So I sort of got to the SEC. You all have passed the Holding Foreign Companies Accountable Act. I think there's those two issues. One is after 19 years after Sarbanes-Oxley, Chair Sarbanes sitting in this chair in this room, passed, and our good friend, our Maryland mentor, yes. I consider a mentor, passed that bipartisan bill. 50-plus jurisdictions have complied, and two have not, China and Hong Kong. So Congress, on a bipartisan basis, again said, let's address that. We've got 3 years. We've had discussions directly with the Chinese authorities. The clock is ticking. But I also think in the meantime, we should enhance the disclosures of the existing companies, these 200-plus companies, as to the political risk, the regulatory risk, and the real financials between China and the Cayman Islands.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Van Hollen. Senator Ossoff is joining us from his office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Chair Gensler, for joining us. The COVID-19 pandemic has presented the most immediate and ongoing threat to the U.S. economy and the global economy of the last 2 years. But beyond the risks presented by the pandemic, Chairman Gensler, as a voting member of the Financial Stability Oversight Council and in your capacity as SEC chair, can you please provide to this committee your assessment of the greatest systemic risks to financial stability in the United States?
We work together at the Financial Stability Oversight Council on an annual report, and we're sort of in the midst of that right now. I think that systemic risk issues, something that could spill over into the whole marketplace, though our capital markets have weathered the storm of this pandemic and actually weathered, I think, better than it would have because of the reforms of Dodd-Frank and the greater capital in the system. There's still risk in the system, whether it's in the commercial real estate area, the reach for yield that a second area I'm mentioning is a reach for yield that many investors, not just retail investors, but investors more broadly are reaching for yield. We in our country are also transitioning off of something that created systemic risk in the past called the London Interbank Offer Rate and the transition away from LIBOR to another set of rates is, I think, being managed well, but it still presents some risk in that transition because there's $200 to $300 trillion of assets on top of that. But I'd say the biggest risk is the healthcare risk itself. And the healthcare risk and how that's managed as a nation and the economic risk associated with that are probably the biggest risks.
You have a three-part mission, Mr. Chairman, to protect investors, to maintain fair, orderly, and efficient markets, and to facilitate capital formation. Could you please inform the committee how you view climate change as impacting that three-part mission and the actions you're going to take in order to protect investors, maintain fair, orderly, and efficient markets, and facilitate capital formation given the projections of significant negative impacts from climate change?
I think that we're taking up two initiatives, and I think both of them relate to all three of the pieces. I think investors increasingly want to know about the climate risk of their companies they own. And I think by bringing consistent, comparable information and standards into this, that the companies themselves will benefit. The companies will benefit because they'll say, ah, now we can compete efficiently in the capital markets by presenting this set of standards around their greenhouse gas emissions and around their management of climate risk. The second docket is around the fund management side, and if they're saying that they're green or sustainable or carbon-free, what stands behind that? But again, I think that that helps investors make decisions and companies raise money. So I think it helps all three of our mission points.
Thank you, Chairman Gensler. And returning to the question of systemic risk and financial stability, in recent testimony before this committee, the Fed chair testified about his concerns regarding money market funds and treasury markets, the performance of money market funds during conditions of financial stress in March of 2020, requiring federal intervention. And he testified regarding treasury markets, quote, that at that time, the treasury market really lost functionality. The most important financial market lost functionality significantly during the acute phase of the crisis, that being the initial onslaught of COVID-19. Do you share the Fed chairman's assessment and concerns regarding money market funds and treasury markets?
I thank you for reminding me. To your earlier question, I should have said the treasury market itself does present the functioning of that market some systemic risks. Three times, October 14, the fall of 19, and the spring of 20, we had more than hiccups inside the treasury market. And it's about the structuring of that market. And so working with Secretary Yellen, Chair Powell, even Acting Chair Benham, I would hope we can bring more resilience through central clearing in that market and also bringing the principal trading firms, the high-frequency trading firms, into that remit. To your other question about money market and open-end funds, we do have that on our docket. As Ranking Member Toomey asked earlier, we do hope to do that, I'd say maybe by Q1 of the year, to address money market funds around the connection between the liquidity provided and what's called gates, but also to look at the liquidity rules themselves in that market, as well as open-end bond funds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate your testimony. And Chairman Brown, I yield back.
Thank you, Senator Ossoff. Thank you, Chair Gensler, for joining us today. For senators who wish to submit questions for the record, those questions are due 1 week from today, Tuesday, September 21st. Chair Gensler, per our committee rules, we ask that you respond to any questions within 45 days from the day you received them. Thank you again. With that, the hearing is adjourned.